Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Thank you for joining us tonight. We are thrilled to have spiritual teacher and author Anata Campbell join us from North Carolina. Anata has studied with some of the greatest Eastern spiritual teachers of the late 20th century, including H.W.L. Punja, J. Krishnamurti, and Osho. Tonight, we want to look at what spiritual awakening is, what enlightenment is, and we want to explore why it's more important than ever right now that we as human beings take on this extraordinary adventure of a lifetime into the incredible possibilities of spiritual liberation. There's a lot to cover tonight, and we'd love to hear your questions and thoughts, so just message us through our Facebook page at Bridge to Everywhere, and we'll ask your questions on the air. Anata's message is powerful and simple. She says, enlightenment and awakening is real. It's who we all already are. There's no one way to get there. And if there is a path, it's to live your own life fully and follow your inner voice. So we really appreciate the down-to-earth and positive approach Anata brings to spirituality, and we're excited to explore this terrain in depth. We're going to draw from her own experience awakening and also from what she's learned from the many stories of awakening she describes in her book, The Ordinary Buddha.
So I'd like to introduce Anata to everyone. Paradoxically, Anata, H.W.L. Punja Enlightened Master said, means, I don't exist. And exactly, that was Anata's experience late one night almost 20 years ago when the ego personality disappeared and was seen to have less reality than smoke and dust. Yet a magical life has transpired regardless. Starting out as a self-described Jesus freak in New York, Anata lived in Oregon and India as a disciple of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. In the presence of H.W.L. Punja, she washed the master's dishes, ate radishes from his hands, and massaged his arm, which had been injured. She spent a beautiful afternoon sitting under the trees in Ojai, California, attending a talk with the late J. Krishnamurti. All in all, Anata eventually traveled to India on seven separate occasions. Continuing the journey in the West to Hawaii and Sedona, she sat with many well-known teachers, finally finding her heart's home back in the town of Tiruvannamalai, India, and has felt blessed. I may have pronounced it, but let's try again. Tiruvannamalai? You're going to have to say that, Anata, India. And has felt blessed sitting at the foot of her ultimate teacher, the sacred mountain, you're going to have to pronounce that one for me, too. Is it Arunachala? Near Ramana Maharshi's ashram, a place where, since ancient times, many enlightened beings have been drawn. When not in India, Anata lived a very ordinary life in Southern California near her three daughters and three grandchildren. Surprisingly, existence has sent her two more teenagers to raise, and she is currently in the mountains of North Carolina doing just that. Along that journey is coming to an end as the kids are almost grown. The ordinary life and deepening into the divine still go on and on, where they join into one blessed existence. And Anata's website is theordinarybuddha.org. That's theordinarybuddha.org. And Anata also has an ebook that you can get from Amazon.
Or Kindle.
Yeah. Or Kindle, on the Amazon Kindle, and it's called The Ordinary Buddha. Welcome to our show, Anata. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's really a real pleasure to be here with you guys. Tiruvannamalai.
Wow. Oh, I never would have got that one. Okay, I can say it now, Tiruvannamalai.
There, like, you go.
Okay, Tiruvannamalai. It sort of sounds like anomaly. That's good. Okay, Tiruvannamalai.
So, Anata, maybe to start with, could you walk us through a little bit of your own journey just from the beginnings, starting as a Jesus freak and then moving forward, and what drew you to the East? And then maybe we'll kind of come back to some of your four major and powerful statements.
And I also want to say, I heard a rumor that you may have grown up on Long Island. Is that true?
Oh, you know what? I lost you there for about a minute.
Okay. So we'll try again. Go ahead, ask your question.
Oh, okay. Well, we just would love to hear a little bit about your background. You're describing a Jesus freak early on, so we'd love to hear about that and how you transitioned to searching for spiritual liberation in the East. And then maybe we can look at some of these four points that you draw, the very powerful statements about awakening.
It's simple. It's so simple. I was born in New York, moved to California, lived there for 4 years, back to New York. But I was Catholic, and you know what? I have a lot in common with Francis Bennett, actually, because I I was very spiritual within the church as a child, even. You know, I think I loved the stories of the saints, especially the young ones. I think I wanted to be a nun for a while. Then I was married for several years, and it really wasn't a good thing. And, you know, in the church, you have to stay married. You know, there's no divorce. So I kind of had to leave the church. But just at that time, I was really, you know, sitting in the ordinary Catholic church, just very in love with Jesus, with that awakened being. You know, I could feel him and above and beyond all the rules and regulations. And, you know, I enjoyed the symbolism in the church and the, you know, the beauty of the ceremonies. But other things didn't really resonate with me, so I left the church. But I was always looking, even when I was still in the church. I was reading books about Easter Island and yoga and whatever I could get my hands on that had to do with something more, searching for God, really.
So
that's where it all started.
So when you say, I think if you could flesh that out a little bit more for people. So, and you know, that so the difference, what your experience was in church is that you were experiencing something, and yet what was actually, you know, the words that were being spoken to you in the church didn't quite resonate, but yet you were having an experience beyond what they were even pointing to in church.
I think there was just a huge love for God and for Jesus. And, you know, I really recognize, I think, looking back, I recognized him as a true teacher. And now I see, and I think Francis Bennett would say the same thing, that he was an enlightened being. And what he was telling us, I and the Father are one, is the same message that we should recognize for ourselves, that we and the Father are one, that you are God, really. So I was kind of, you know, and I wasn't really going into esoteric. It was just a love space then. But I kept searching and looking and started into yoga. And one of my yoga teachers went to India and came back with meditations from Osho, who was called Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh then. And they were beautiful meditations, active meditations, excuse me, but also his discourses. And everything that he said resonated as truth. It was like he would say something and I would know it was true, as if I had always known it, but I never had those words in my brain. You know, we resonate with truth when we hear it. And also, I think when I saw pictures of him and videos, there was something going on in those eyes that I've never seen before. And people were saying he was enlightened. And I was saying to my, what's that? You know, I wasn't looking for enlightenment, but I saw something in this man. Something was cooking there that I had never really experienced. And that's really, you know, from then on, that's what I was going for, without even really, really acknowledging it. But I was searching for that light that he had and that peace and stillness.
Did you find that in his presence that you experience that quality emanating from within your own self?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you would go in and sit with him, and sometimes you would just cry. You know, you would just, something in him just would penetrate, and you would just cry. Other times you were just buzzing with energy. There was so much going on with, that man was really remarkable for what he could project to you somehow.
Or transmit.
Hello?
I'm sorry, was it transmit? Or we used the word
transmit,
Transmit, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, he was quite a character, and there was quite a thing around it. I mean, you know, but this was one way. And, you know, what I've learned is that there's, and I didn't immediately get enlightened by any means. It was just, there was a love thing going on there with the whole community. When you are, you know, around a particular master, I think that's very common with people who've done that. There's just so much love that you feel for the master, and what you're really experiencing is yourself. And that's what a good master will tell you. It's not him as a personality, but he's transmitting that essence that you are, and it just, it hits you as if it's him, but it's not.
Was it a challenge for you to to move away from the idea that Christ being sort of a singular embodiment of spiritual power and goodness and virtue in the Catholic tradition, where it's really Jesus is it, and to here have a living human being that's representing this kind of luminosity, and that there's a whole structure built up around him, and there's almost a the quality of an ashram atmosphere. Was that a hard transition or awkward in any way?
No, it was delightful, and really delightful. And what happened was I'd read a book by Osho, so this is where the transition comes in. I read a book, and he had said, this is why I went to India, you have missed in many lifetimes. And I just saw this image of me in a crowd behind, as if it was a past life. And I'm not a real woo-woo. I don't have these all the time, but this came to me. I'm in the back of the crowd, and there's Jesus. And he says, come follow me, and I don't. I just felt that so strongly, and it was so, so sad. It was like heartbreaking that I didn't follow him then. And so I said, I'm not going to miss in this life. And I think this is a key. This is key for people to, when you feel pulled in a spiritual direction, go. Whatever it is, your own path, follow it. And so I went to India because of really that. So it was really the fact of having missed Jesus in that life, and I felt, it's the same being, it's the same soul, it's the same God that's represented and shown us through these beings. So it was just joyful. It was like, hooray, I've this lifetime I haven't missed.
And then what happened then? At some point you moved on?
Well, Osho passed away, and then before I met H.W.L. Punja, Papaji, I was still searching. What was I doing? Just living life, pretty much. I was going to a spiritual center where, we would meditate and just have it was very light. I mean, I've never done any horrible ascetic, things where I'm beating myself or starving myself or any of that. It was all just joyful. And so it was a fun environment, in the meditation center, and just continued on. And then one day I just got really disgusted about, it's been, 20 years I've been searching for God and for reality and truth, and I just demanded to know what is real. And the thing that made it work is that I was willing to let everything go. I mean, this was really, really deep in me and really serious. I wasn't going to step a foot until I knew what reality was. And the question of what is reality, it wasn't, reality is God or something good. I had no idea. Maybe reality is horrible. I just didn't know. I had this huge question, and I wasn't going to move. And then it was revealed to me. And what I saw was, and people don't like this so much, but I saw Buddha, then that was who I was. But with that seeing Buddha, the personality stepped aside, and the Buddha was me, and the Buddha represents, I knew I wasn't a Buddha, I didn't turn into it, but peace and contentedness and bliss, really, and God. What I realized from that, and like Adi Ashanti in my book says, he had his experience also of a Buddha, but that then there were these downloads, and everybody who wakes up has these downloads if it's a real awakening, because you can have nice experiences, beautiful experiences, without the ego stepping aside. Once the ego steps aside, what's left is God, is the grounding of your existence, the grounding of who you are, and that is all of this, peace, love, oneness, and you and I and everybody else is all exactly the same, and that's what's understood. So if anybody wakes up and they say they're better than you, they haven't woken up.
What you're describing, I think there's a few things in there that I wanted to flesh out. One is what you said about just saying, I'm not going to move until I get this answer, you know, after 30 years of just getting fed up. And that is sort of reminiscent of the Buddha story of Buddha under the Bodhi tree saying, I'm not going to move until I become enlightened. You know, so there is. So when you said I became a Buddha, it sort of makes sense when you took that stance. But the other thing is what you...
That's funny. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the story, that's right? Great. Where he says, I'm not moving until I discover the truth. And so that it seems like people have to come to that place where it's like, okay, I'm going to take my stand and I'm not going to move until the truth reveals itself. But you're also talking a little bit about a difference between a seeker and a finder. Is that a lot of people get on the spiritual path for a particular kind of experience. And it sounds like, you know, the experience that you're having is amazing. But at a certain point, you still have to come to terms with the fact that you haven't really yet let go of your ego. And so at what point, and then the other question that comes into, does experience actually change you, or do you have to do something? Like what you actually have to take a stand for something, and that was what allowed your ego to release.
Well, that was my story, and apparently that was the Buddha story.
Right.
And, you know, for me, I think that was really unique, and I forgot. I mean, I really forgot about that story with the Buddha. I should have not. I mean, I wasn't a Buddhist.
Right.
You know.
How would you know?
I was a Buddha. Osho says, don't become a Buddhist, become a Buddha. Uh-huh. Don't become a Christian, become a Christ. So... for me, that was my way, and that was very almost aggressive, but the aggressiveness was, you know, was the willingness to drop the ego, to just say, kill me now or tell me the truth is really what it was. But that's kind of unusual. There are many stories, you know, 13 stories in my book. There's different chapters. One was Osho, one was Papaji, one was Zen, and one was life-centered awakenings. So some people, like Byron Katie, it just hit her over the head. She wasn't even looking. She wasn't demanding. She was just kind of crazy at that time. And she woke up on the floor of a halfway house fully awake and has never changed from that day. And I think her awakening was more like actually Ramana Maharshi's awakening. Ramana Maharshi is the saint that lived in Tiruvannamalai. At the foot of the mountain Arunachala, which is a sacred mountain in India for thousands of years. He woke up very similarly. He was a child. He was 16. And he just it came over him, what is it like to die? And he just lay down and he died, I mean, within his consciousness. He just experienced, what is it like? He let his body go stiff. And then it was like Byron Katie, fully awake.
I think Eckhart Tolle had a similar awakening as well. He spent a lot of his years pretty unhappy, and then I think in his late 20s had a similar realization. It just he just all of a sudden everything let go. It wasn't something that he was actually working towards.
I think he was described being nearly suicidal, and he just had this moment where he just I cannot live with myself. And in that there was a split. He's like, well, wait a second,
who
can't live with who? and he saw through the mind in an instant. And I think that, you know, I guess there can be a crisis, a level like what you describe is an intensity. The sheer unacceptability of living unfree and then that creates a real opening, I suppose, a space to see the truth.
I love that, living unfree. Yeah, it's like you just can't stand it anymore. And many people, you know, it's interesting. There's so many ways. That's why I say there's no one way to get there. You have to follow your life. Because what I see in so many people, too, are they're perfectly happy. When I went to Osho, I was perfectly happy. I had a good life. I had no complaints. So I wasn't coming out of some angst or some drug addiction or anything like that, that people say then they kind of get religion. You know, I was coming from a happiness. But I see ordinary people like me who are just piece by piece becoming happier and happier and happier, you know, more and more content. And so they, you know, and I feel like some people just kind of are going to spill into this, you know, from happiness without having to fight or get intense. It's all different. It's different for all people. It's just an amazing thing, really, how unique it is. But the understanding, For me, enlightenment is when your ego separates from, you know, your identity separates from your ego too, and it gravitates to truth.
So would you say awakening is a glimpse or a powerful recognition, but enlightenment would be, there'd be a distinction that there's a final severing of identification with ego?
It could be. And I don't know for sure. That these are words that really describe something that's hard to put into words. For me, I think awakening and enlightenment, because I felt that I was enlightened when I had my experience, because I was no longer myself. You know, I didn't identify with myself. I identified with that, I called it. And then I had another experience a short time later where I completely didn't exist at all, except there was a body and an energy, and there was no me. There was no no-me. There was nothing.
I was going to say, let's just for a moment imagine people listening to you thinking, like, from an ego standpoint, no way, why would I want that?
That doesn't sound very good.
It doesn't sound good at all.
To the ego, it doesn't sound particularly appealing.
Yeah.
So I guess,
you know what? It doesn't. I'll tell you what. The ego is the thing that's fighting to stay alive.
Right.
And in that experience, it really wasn't a pleasant experience. It really wasn't. It was like, wow, now what am I going to do? I mean, as I'm saying an I, but I know there's no I, it's very confusing to talk about. But there was really, how am I going to be a mother to the child I was raising at the time, my youngest daughter, as a teenager? And how am I going to walk? I was sitting in bed, and I just actually brought myself back in. I talked to Byron Katie about it, and it's in the last chapters in my book about this. And she said, you didn't have to bring yourself back in. You could have stayed there. But what I found afterwards, even though it wasn't even a good experience, it wasn't blissful, afterwards it was, because I no longer had an attachment. I really had even less attachment than I had in the first experience to an ego. And I knew it was, like we said, you said earlier, smoke and dust. And so nothing could harm me, because there was no me to be harmed. There was nothing finite or you know, injurable. Even if I died, that wasn't a problem. So, you know, life becomes really very beautiful. That's the thing. And then there's the ongoing deepening that happens, and it gets good. But I have something here I'd like to read. It's Symptoms of Inner Peace. So you have these experiences, and my sister said to me one day, what good is it? You know, why would you want to have that? You know, you don't want to have an ego. What's that about? It, you know, it can be a clinical problem in some instances.
Well, it probably is in the DSM-4 book. there's probably defined
in there
as an illness that you can put somebody on a medication for. So you got to be really careful who you tell you're enlightened.
It's really true, because in the past, I think many people were in institutions when they had really profound experiences where they didn't come back very well, you know. But I function quite well in the world. But these are symptoms of inner peace, which is really basically enlightenment. And these are all things that I experience now, and I did experience pretty close to when I had it, immediately, really. One is the tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than from fear based on past experiences. And that is really true. Fear just drops. So much fear just drops. An unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. And so these are good reasons. Wake up, people.
They sound good.
The second is loss of interest in judging other people. That's a big one. You can't do it. Loss of interest in judging self. Because even, you know, my ego, I did used to judge my ego in the beginning, and then I learned that it's okay. It's just a small child. It's still going to do its thing. And I can just love it as a small child and move on. So you don't, not even attached to, if I did something goofy that day, you know. So loss of interest in interpreting the actions of others, that's a very big one for me. They do what they do. They just do what they do. And it's, you know, I think before that it was like, why are they doing that? I don't do that. I don't even have those words in my consciousness anymore. Loss of interest in conflict. Loss of ability to worry, and it says here, very serious symptom. Frequent overwhelming episodes of appreciation.
That one's great.
That's me. That's me now. And it's gotten that way in the last few years, more and more and more. I just go around goofy now. Like, so contented feelings of contentedness with others and nature. Frequent attacks of smiling through the eyes from the heart. Increased tendency to let things happen rather than make them happen. Increased susceptibility to love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend love. And that's it. I mean, that last one hits me, the uncontrollable urge to extend love. You just want to cry all the
time.
That's
beautiful. Is that list in your book, or is that up on your website?
You know what? I'm going to put it up there.
Yeah, that should definitely...
And post it on our Facebook page,
Yeah, post it on our Facebook
event.
Page,
on Facebook,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this came, believe it or not, this came from something that was stuck on my friend's refrigerator door many years ago.
I love it. It's beautiful.
An author unknown. It's just... Yeah, and it's all exactly the truth. And when I look at it now, and like I said, this deepening has happened over the... So 20 years, it took me 20 years to get that awakening. Then it was 20 years since... And recently I realized that these 20 years have been as powerful as those moments.
That's awesome.
Just living my life. And because I've been through many things, I've had rough times. You know, it doesn't make everything nice, you know, every day.
Yeah, and I think that's the myth that's out there, that in some way you somehow become dead to the world and you no longer experience all of the human, you know, all the human emotions. And it seems like, if anything, the people that I really have been inspired by, they're so full of life that their capacities as human beings are amplified many, many fold. So their capacities for loving and for creativity and for just generosity is overwhelming and inspiring to be in their presence.
That's exactly what happens.
And the other thing about that list, it's that you're not experiencing life through a separate self sense. You know, through a projected separate self sense that's based on your, you know, all of your life experience, your fears and desires, all of your conditioning. It's like you can drop that and just take life in every single moment. And what a difference.
That's it. And you know, I have to say too, because this is really ordinary, and a person doesn't become extraordinary, you know, in many ways, but you are still just yourself. And I think it's kind of filtered through your personality. Your personality is still there, and it just changes.
Beautiful.
You know.
Anata, we're going to take a brief break here, and okay. We'll be right back. You're listening
All
to
right.
The Bridge to Everywhere with Anata Campbell.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere, and we are in the middle of talking to Anata Campbell. She's the author of The Ordinary Buddha, which is available on Amazon Kindle, and you can also visit her website at www.theordinarybuddha.org. And we were just about to have her read from a passage in her book called What is Enlightenment? So go ahead, Anata.
Okay. This was at the very beginning of an older book. I'm not even sure it's in the new one, but it's pretty good. It really says a lot. So enlightenment is something of the mind that understands something beyond mind. It is a waking up of an individual to who they truly are. Although the essential understanding is the same for everyone, the initial experience is unique to each person. Whatever form it takes, we see by direct experience that the personality you thought you were is non-existent. It is what some call freedom from the small self, and others call discovering self with a capital S. We are freed from our attachment to our ego or small self. That's an important point. We are freed from our attachment to our ego or small self, and we discover the vastness that is our true self. We are awake to our divinity, the common ground of all beingness, from the smallest bug to the grandest mountain peak. It's all made of that you are. What enlightenment isn't is a particular state of bliss, happiness, or joy. It is not an absence of sorrow, misery, or other uncomfortable emotions. The experience of these fluctuating emotions continues, though we no longer attach to them. We know that who we are is the grounding underneath all of that. All states are welcome in that knowing. The highest enlightenment is said not to be a state of utter bliss where outside awareness is diminished, but to be the natural state, relaxed and natural, not eliminating the world, but embracing it in love, fully integrated. We recognize that this body-mind personality is a divine play that is born directly out of the truth of our nature. That essence that is the same in everything we see and experience around us. To live life in alignment with our truth, once we have experienced it, we must remember who we really are underneath states of happiness, unhappiness, joy, fear, and even misery. This is the vigilance that Papaji talks about, the way to keep the ego in alignment with truth. Once you wake up, you know that the thoughts and emotions that constantly come and go are really nothing more than electrical impulses. This is the truth. Though they continue to come up, you no longer believe them as real. Stepping outside the habitual constant chatter, you can watch yourself think. The mind is now a servant and not the boss. Although thoughts are not reality, they do create our worldly existence. As we get caught up in the drama, a moment comes when we again remember the freedom that is our unchanging nature, and we are brought back again to rest in that peace. The more we rest in grace, the more that identifying with truth becomes our habit.
That's beautiful.
I think
that's the deepening.
One of the things that I heard in what you're saying about the experience of emotions, I think I've heard some people say that they want to be enlightened so that they can stop having all the negative emotions and the negative thoughts and the negative feelings. And what you're pointing to about them just being electrical impulses, first of all, we're Chinese medical practitioners, so we sort of see them as internal weather patterns. And we know from where we live in Alaska that if you just wait 5 minutes, the weather will change. So that it really doesn't say anything inherently about who you are. So that's one thing about emotions that I think that thinking that somehow we would reach a state where they would stop happening, I don't think there's any way for us as human beings to interact with our environment and not have these electrical impulses or weather patterns happen. But like you were saying, it's our state of attachment to them or not. How attached we are to them, how much we believe those things to be reality, or how much we just see them as they're just movements that are happening in us or in other people, and we're able to just say a one big yes to what's actually happening.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head. Yeah, that's it. But it does change. This is interesting because, when you're having one, an emotion, you're having it. But it really, like I said, the more you identify, the more you rest in grace, the more that you identify with truth, the more it just settles. Things do really, really settle. And now, I have... desires occasionally, and when they don't come to pass, it's so okay. If it came about, that's great. If it didn't, it's great. And it really does, you change, because you don't believe, it becomes unimportant what those electrical impulses are telling you. It's just the record.
The idea that desire somehow is going, I think we talk about there's two ways of being unhappy, and one is getting what you want and the other is not getting what you want.
Yeah.
Because that impulse of like, I want this thing, whatever it is, and then we, in our small self, we think somehow getting that thing is going to complete us, whether it's the job or the house or the car or the relationship or the child. Or, just fill in the blank. I think Eckhart Tolle talks about having a piece of chocolate cake. He's like, I would like to have that piece of chocolate cake, but whether I have it or not really doesn't matter.
That's exactly right. That's exactly how I feel now. It's how it has come to me. And this has been, like I say, the 20 years of deepening stuff going on. It's just, and this, people say, oh, I want another experience, because I did in the beginning. Those were cool. I want more. And then you're trying to grab at experience. And after a while, you just relax and realize. Somebody, I think, said it to me, and this kind of woke me up in that area. You're greedy.
Yeah.
You've had these things. Not everybody even gets to have them in a lifetime. And now the thing about having these awakening experiences, the experience was blissful for me for about 8 months, the first one. I was just living high all the time. What was I going to say about that?
Well, what I'm thinking, what I'm kind of getting from that is that you can have an experience, but what is your response to it? At a deep level, you've seen something that's profoundly true.
Yeah.
And so there's a knowledge. And
that's exactly the word I was going to say, and I forgot my thought. Exactly. Thank you.
Sure.
And then I would add to it, like, how many experiences do you have to have until you rest in that as being the truth? You know, so again, that goes back to that conversation about seeking versus finding. Once you've seen the truth and you know it to be the truth, it is sort of greedy to go and keep on and on and on, having to have more and more experience. But that, again, that sort of, that goes back to the way our culture is, in a way, that we're always seeking for experience. We want more and more and more. But if we actually look at, what does that, what has that experience taught me? What have I learned from that? What do I know now? Do I need to have more of that, or do I just live from that place?
Yeah, Eckhart Tolle.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm.
Eckhart Tolle uses the example, you know, you don't stand in front of the mirror and say, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man. You know, that at a certain point, this is not something that you need to have affirmed. And now I think that there must be something, that's obviously disorienting to habitually be identified with objects for a sense of self. And what you're pointing to is really it doesn't have a location in the center of any, it has no location. It's nowhere and everywhere. The nature of consciousness is unlimited. Yeah. That's the freedom. And so I would imagine a kind of a process of just orienting around that kind of vastness. There's still going to be habits and tendencies, but I think that's the integration process, and it's probably different
perfect.
For everyone.
Orienting around the vastness, that's good. What I was going to say is what you had said, use the word knowledge. What your experience is, really what awakening is knowledge, is the knowledge that you don't really exist as an ego. I mean, you really don't. It's like if you have a painting, you have a blank canvas. What we've been doing all our life is putting paint on there, creating something that others can see and that you can also experience as a self. But what you really are is that blank canvas. So it's that knowing, and that's just one way of saying it. But the experience of awakening is profoundly dropping. You are no longer there. You experience this other. But the knowledge remains. And like I was in bliss for 8 months is what I started saying. I lost track because that was too much fun. but then coming back from that, people say, oh, I lost it. Well, you've never lost it. Did you lose the knowledge of that you are one and that we are all the same and that, all of the download that you get from the experience is always present with you? And I use the analogy of, like, if you've never seen the color red, you live in a land where there's no red, and then you cross a line to another state and you see red and there's a label, red. And now you can talk about red like you can talk about enlightenment, but there's no way of knowing that if you don't see it for yourself. So, and then once you've seen that color red and you move back to your land where there's no red again, you'll never forget. You'll always know. You'll always have that within you. So this is one way of looking at it.
What are some of the common pitfalls and obstacles that you've seen in the people you've talked to who've had awakening and the various types of awakenings they've had? Are there some common obstacles that you've encountered or heard about?
I was saying to you on the phone the other day that I had took a group to India to see poverty one time, and there was a man named Fred in the group, an older man. He was quite a character, and he was trying so hard, to get it, and just wasn't sort of happening. And he came up to Papaji, and he wrote a letter. Papaji, what are my obstacles? And he sat in front of Papaji, and Papaji said, the only obstacle you have is Fred. So the only obstacle is this attachment to who I am. Because we get so attached, it's so important who I am and what others think of me and all of this. And that's why it doesn't sound good to lose your ego, because your ego is who you think you are. It's just not true. You're so much bigger and so much happier than an ego can provide for you in this life.
I'm remembering a conversation I had with Kevin. I'm thinking it was about, 8 or 9 years ago, where I just got fed up with my personality. I was just like, I'm just done with this person. It's just like this recognition that, but it's kind of like that Eckhart Tolle thing, though, of like that. So if I'm done with it, then I must not be it. You know, and to me, that seems to be like the first step on recognizing
yes.
If there's some part of you that could actually say that, like I'm done with this, Sam.
Yeah. Yeah.
then again, it's like who is it who's done with it, and then I must not actually be Sam. Like
you know,
I couldn't be done with Sam.
And if you trace yeah. it back, and mm-hmm. this is I think the role of attention. If you trace that back, the source. It feels bigger and open and love and joy and all this space begins to fill in.
I think, I don't know if there's so much about obstacles other than you're attached to your ego, you're attached to your things, you're attached to your life. You know, you're attached to your entertainment. And part of that entertainment, you know, could be, I want more experience, spiritual experience. It's entertainment. You know, there's so much better stuff than that, the reality of the joy of living and love. But I think one way, you know, is what you're saying now, and most teachers that I hear are just saying, just look back into, you say, beyond, you know, this ego that you want to change. And I had already had these experiences. My ego was still functioning, and I just really was mad at it, you know, for a while. I had to soften up with that. But then the ego does soften itself, you know, little by little. It just, because the truth becomes more of who you are, the ego becomes less. Just a gift over time. You just have to relax.
Could it also be said that you are less interested in the ego and its
yes.
agenda?
Oh, I'm not interested at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me at all anymore. It just does its thing. I speak through it, I think. But I think my speaking even is, there's so much... I don't see a me in here anymore. I just see it sort of an emptiness, and then I'm speaking, and it's coming through. It's more and more. It's just how I experience myself. But what the teachers are saying is, look in. Who am I? And my question was similar. What is reality? But what is this? You know, what is it? Just look beyond your thoughts. Look, you know, it's beyond thinking. And it was meditation, that's just becoming very quiet. And people take years to learn how to quiet their mind, but it doesn't even have to take that long if you just really relax. And it's so easy. It really can be the easiest thing there is just to be still. And what is it? Just look and see what is it that's left.
And we teach meditation, and that's a common. We see that pitfall often with people thinking that they're not doing it right if their mind is busy. You know,
right.
if they can't quiet their mind. But it's really about reaching more of, I think Francis refers to it as a state of no preference. He talks about being in the from the perspective of like you have the room and you have the space in the room, and the room itself. Or the space in the room, rather, doesn't care what's going on in the room. He gives the example of somebody could come in and throw mud all over the room, or somebody could throw rose petals all over the room. And from the perspective of the space in the room, you know, there would be no preference. It really doesn't matter if it's mud or it's roses. Now, the people in the room, like myself, I would prefer that it was roses and not mud. But from that state of no preference, you can actually sit and be meditating and still have a busy mind. You can the mind can just be doing its thing, kind of like what you said earlier. It's the little kid that's going off and having a temper tantrum, but you're not being sucked into it. It's just doing its thing. And the other thing is it's not taking up the same amount of space as it used to in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way I think about it is this: it's just a state of awareness. So it's like unfiltered awareness. And in that larger awareness, all the things that were happening before are still happening, but none of those things are taking up. If something was right in front of you and that was all you could see versus like it's really, really far away in the background, you know it's still going on and you could look at it if you wanted to, but you're not identified with it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. I think when you were talking about all this busyness going on and you're sitting and trying to meditate or you are meditating, if you could just look, you know, at what's behind it, what's behind all of this busy that's mm-hmm. going on, if you can just see that stillness behind it, that's a help. But, you know, how to really let go of your ego, that's a tricky thing. But I think the way to do it is, like I said before, is just follow your life and do what you feel to do. Follow your voice. Don't, you know, you don't have to do what somebody else tells you. If it doesn't feel right, I should. Don't should yourself. But, you know, live your life fully. And if you want to really find out who you are, you know, you do have to have a kind of an intensity and an opening for whatever is next and where you're led with that intention.
Does this require
really discovering yourself?
Anata, can somebody have this direct experience on their own? Do they need a teacher, do you feel? What is the role of the teacher, in your opinion?
Well, I did, you know, but actually my experience didn't come sitting with a teacher directly. I had experiences with him and other teachers, but this came because I was just disgusted. And you know, like, obviously I said, like, with Byron Katie and other people in my book, Troy's awakening came out of him listening to his own voice. He was into alcohol and drugs and a very, very difficult childhood growing up, and his voice said, sit down, and he just sat down. And it said, breathe, and he would breathe. And eventually that wound up to be meditation. He had never heard of meditation. And he eventually looked in the mirror and saw God there. He had no teacher except his own inner voice. And that's why I say, follow your voice. And if your voice says, I love that man, I want to follow that teacher or that woman, and you go to follow, that's your voice. So listen to that. It, you know, everything, it's really unique. Like I said, it's unique for each person.
Are there some guidelines for listening to? I mean, a lot of people have voices in their heads. So is there a discernment that would really help people, you know, guide people to what voices to listen to?
You know, somebody asked Byron Katie that, and she said, the one you argue with. So if at night it says, go brush your teeth, and I say, I don't feel like it, I'm tired, I'm arguing. The voice said, go brush your teeth. So, I mean, the voice for me was, you know, when I read that book, and it said, you've missed in many lifetimes, it was obvious. Adi Ashanti says, people say, how do I know what to do next? And he said, the next obvious thing. It's just obvious. We argue. We do a lot of arguing in our brain. But you kind of really do know what the voice is. If you really, you know where your heart is going, and that's what to do. But the one you argue with and the next obvious thing, those are two keys.
I have a theory sometimes that people, when they don't listen to that voice, mm-hmm. That's really where they try not to, or because they feel like for whatever reason, you know, culturally it's not acceptable, they're not supposed to be doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where some of the drugs that are pharmaceutical drugs that are actually abused in this country, like Prozac and Paxil, just because that sort of feeling like something's not right, that internal feeling of unhappiness, I think sometimes is because the voice is there and the person is actually choosing not to listen to it. And then then they can get into a state of, you know, sort of perpetual unhappiness and misery, but really it's, you know, they're still telling that voice to shut up. And you can take some of those meds and not have to listen to the voice of the truth anymore. And so, you know, that's really sad and kind of disturbing, actually, that we do that. That we'll sort of know it's the voice of the truth, but we'll tell it basically to shut up because it doesn't seem like it's in alignment with everything that everyone else around us is telling us.
Or it's just really inconvenient for mm-hmm. the life a person has constructed.
Exactly.
Yeah, that alignment is an important word there too, because even though you have these experiences, you have to stay in alignment with it, and people do go off into addiction, even though they've already had this. So it's really important to maintain your health and eat right and exercise and, you know, all the things that I know you guys are about, and live a good life and do good on the planet and, you know, do the best you can in all ways. And this is how you stay in alignment. I mean, we're talking about experiencing the truth of yourself as God, as all of it, as infinity, divinity. This is who you really, really are. And you want to stay in alignment with that. And you can go off in your ego and mess up and, you know, if I eat too much sugar, you know, I'm off kilter. So, you know, I have to stay in alignment. And I think where my bliss is coming in now, that's just so amazing. I mean, I have a unconditional love, you know, that's in me for myself, for everything. And it's not based on anything, conditions, you know. It's just whatever it is. Right now in front of me is where the love is. But, yeah, I lost my thought again. I get so excited.
It's the love.
It's the love. Yeah.
Well, it's a hard conversation to have, I think, because we're sort of talking. I mean, there's no way you can really talk about what it is that we're trying to talk about.
Yeah, we're using kind of the mind and the intellect to probe beyond the mind and
the
intellect.
Exactly.
And
beyond mind. I just want to hand it to everyone. You know, you just want to say, here, take this, you know, and it can't be done. You have to, but it's your own path, your own life. This is the important thing, I think, to really know that nobody has a market on it. I don't care what religion or culture or ashram, they don't have the market on enlightenment. It's for you to, you're going to get this if you really want it and just be open and live your life fully, whatever that means.
In the simplest terms, I mean, could we say that this is just being yourself? I mean, not yourself, the ego personality you think yourself to be, not what other people, not something that would be nice to be or cool to be, but if you just penetrate deeper and deeper into that fundamental sense of being, of presence, your own sweet presence, that it, you know, sometimes you'll experience it as you're drifting before you go to bed. It feels so good to lay down after a busy day, and you let go of everything. And there's that moment where you think, "Ah, this is great."
That's who you are. That's who you are. And looking at a sunset, where you get lost in the sunset, or a beautiful sky at night, or
where you just feel more yourself. Then it's just uncomplicated, very simple.
I remember what I was going to say. I was going to say that what's been happening for me now, when you talked about alignment, is because I've been following my voice and moving into where I really feel the joy, and that's why it's happening this way. It's just more and more listening to the voice and, oh, the heck with the culture, that says you're weird, whatever. But, and Osho said, just be yourself. And what I got out of that was, just be yourself. That means even in your personality, if you are who you are in that moment, you are going to be led to this ultimate self. But just be yourself, because I can be myself, and then I can also act like this, or I can, do what somebody else thinks I should do. That's not just being yourself. So that means purely do what really you feel in your heart, and that's really pretty much what I'm saying. It's going to bring you there.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a lot of flexibility in that to accommodate the circumstance or the moment, because there's moments that'll call us to be many different things as life unfolds in unpredictable ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is not stagnant. You're not going to, and Osho would also say, if you would like have a 9-to-5 job, or if you always, fold your newspaper that way, well, today fold it differently. and then maybe take a part-time job, whatever. I'm not saying you don't have to change your life that much, but do something opposite of how you do it this day, Just do something different. Shake yourself up, too. When you get into such a rut of habits, that's partly your ego is doing that as well.
I call it calcified thinking. Sometimes,
yeah.
where I see that, especially amongst people who've been doing the same thing over and over. There can be a spiritual practice towards just committing to something and doing it. It's chop wood, carry water kind of spiritual practice, where you just do it, and it's just what needs to be done. But there can also be a way in which you can develop kind of a calcification that doesn't allow for that flexibility to do something different.
Yeah, there's a rock and roll song. Take Another Way Home. You know that song?
Take the long way home?
Take the long way home. That's it. Take the long way home.
Right.
I love that song.
Yeah.
Just go somewhere different,
Exactly. Just get yourself out of the usual and see what you see.
Yeah. And enjoy life. Mm-hmm. I think that this is not something that you have to, whip yourself, with this what they do with the whips with all the thorns on them. You don't have to do that to get awake.
Oh, bummer, because we were going to be selling those whips with the thorns after the show. Now you've ruined our whole plan.
Uh-oh.
I want to come up with
another item. Maybe a T-shirt with a picture of a whip.
Hey, Anata,
I'll tell you what. Frankly, if that's your way, then that's what you got
to
do.
Anata, I wanted to ask you, how do we understand the ego? There's some that say, well, the ego does not exist at an absolute level, that it does not. At a relative level, this is a function of the human nervous system. It's evolved over time to fulfill a purpose, probably for survival. Is this just an evolutionary appendage that's outlived its usefulness and now is threatening the next leap forward?
Yeah, That's good. Adyashanti says the mind, which you could say ego, the mind is a wonderful tool, but a lousy boss. So use it. Use your ego as a tool. It has a function.
It gets you places where you need to go. You show up on time or close to on time. Reminds you need to eat, all that kind of stuff. But there's other ways in which it's not useful.
Yeah.
So that brings up another question about, and really down to the last few minutes here, but is this happening more and more? I mean, I think in our conversation, you said when you first wrote your book, it was really hard to find a lot of really great stories, and now you're hearing them all the time. Is that true?
Well, not only am I hearing them, but I'm living with people. You know, in a room full of people, there might be five who are, you know, awake, who've had awakening experiences out of a room of 15 people. That just didn't happen. You know, it really is becoming, you know, exponentially, you know, like I said, a landslide. It's happening. So there is, I don't know what's going on, but I predicted it because I said in my book that, you know, when I wrote this was, I started writing this in 1994, that soon becoming awake will be the norm because it's happening all around us, you know, like flowers bursting into bloom.
Do you do consultations with people like Francis does, or can people call you up and have a conversation about this? Is that something that you do?
I actually have started doing that, yeah. And that's very, I love it because, I love it. That's all I can say. Because it's being with other souls. And I just spoke with a beautiful woman who had an experience and just, well, now what kind of thing. And it was all new to her and just needed a companion on the path to share that and, you know, discuss it.
And how should people follow up with you if they want to connect?
They should go to, well, they can, I would say the best way is to go to my email, which is 11 Sunyata, S-U-N-Y-A-T-A, 11 Sunyata at gmail.com. That's the best way to get a hold of me right now because my website isn't really very interactive back and forth.
Is 11th spelled out, or is that the number 11th?
Two ones, yeah.
Two ones.
Two ones, yeah, numbers. And SUNYATA at gmail.com.
Okay.
I also am on Facebook. There's The Ordinary Buddha on Facebook. People can contact me there. You have to notice to put the in the front, or you won't find it, The Ordinary Buddha. And
we have theordinarybuddha.org. Is that not .org?
Yeah, that's my website.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm also on Facebook.
Okay. Oh, great.
Name.
Got it.
Yeah. And then what else? That's about it. Yeah.
That's great. And you also have a wonderful interview with Rick Archer on Buddha at the Gas Pump. And I recommend everyone, if they aren't already aware of Rick's show, to go to his website, Buddha at the Gas Pump, BATGAP, as an acronym, BATGAP.com. And you'll find Anata's interview there with a lot of others.
Yeah.
So we've run out of time, and we just want to say thank you so much, Anata, for joining us tonight. This has been a great conversation. Hope to have you on the show again.
Take care, Anata. Have a great night.
You're so welcome. This has just been blissful for me.
Okay.
Really? I love you guys.
We love you, too.
Lots of love.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.